Your friend, your parent, your child, or you could be suffering from mental illness and addiction. The distress, the pain. The suffering ceases when it is confronted together. The recovery begins when we learn to communicate. For the next hour, this station is reaching its hand out to you to help recognize the problem, be part of your solution, and let you know that you're not alone. You're not alone. I'm listening.
Thank you for tuning in for the local Baltimore, Washington segment of I'm Listening. I'm Jason Kidd from 94.7 The Drive in Washington, D.C. and do the morning drive there.
And I'm Gina Crash. I co-host the Today's 101.9 morning show. We're here representing Entercom, D.C. and Baltimore. And we're happy to introduce our guests, too.
Lisa Diorti, did I have that right?
You got it.
The CEO of the Recovery Center of America's Maryland Center for Addiction Treatment. Thank you for stopping by.
Which we can also refer to as MCAT, right?
Absolutely.
That's easy. And Steve Hsu is the director of Maryland's Opioid Operational Command Center. He's also joining us today.
Good morning, Jason.
Good morning.
And Gina.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Steve. Also, Mike Gimble here in the studio. Mike, you are the president of Mike Gimble & Associates. Mike has held positions as the drug czar of Baltimore County, director of substance abuse for the Shepherd Pratt Health System, and is host of the syndicated drug education TV show Straight Talk. Welcome. Thank you.
It's good to be here.
All right. Well, first question here, Steve, for you on the phone. As the head of Maryland's Opioid Operational Command Center, you see firsthand how this crisis affects Maryland families. Can you talk a little about how this epidemic has grown in our community?
It has grown dramatically in the last several years. Heroin and opioids have always been with us. And as far back as 2011, 2012, it was a relatively small number of people who were affected. A small number of fatalities always occurred every year in Maryland. But around 2012, 2013, we saw a very sudden increase in the use of heroin in Maryland. And that happened for a lot of reasons. Innovations in the heroin supply chain, a dramatic increase in production in South and Central America, supplanting Asian production of heroin, a much more potent heroin, a number of factors all came together. And then something really awful happened in 2016. A synthetic opioid called fentanyl started to sweep across Maryland, and it fueled a 70% increase in the number of fatalities. Over 1,800 people in Maryland died in the year 2016. And then in 2017 and 18, the number of fatalities continued to increase to more than 2,000 of our friends, family members, neighbors died as a result of using illegal opiates, heroin and fentanyl analogs. The situation today is extremely concerning because fentanyl is so easy to manufacture, so potent, so easy to transport and easy to hide, and so inexpensive that dealers are mixing it into everything they sell. There's almost no such thing as pure heroin anymore. It's all mixed with fentanyl, at least 90%. Same with cocaine. Cocaine is mostly now mixed with this synthetic opioid, this synthetic heroin-like substance, fentanyl, and it is killing people. Even marijuana is being adulterated with this drug. People, young people think they're using traditional marijuana. It is very likely that they're not. They're probably ingesting synthetic opioids and risking their lives. Over 90% of all opioid-related fatalities in Maryland today relate to fentanyl. Now, there is some good news. Thanks to a lot of really good work by a lot of people, many of them met on your panel today, over the last 10 years, has finally set the stage for getting our arms around this crisis. In the first quarter of 2019, we saw the first decline in the number of opioid-related fatalities in Maryland in a decade. Fatalities were down 14%, and I couldn't have been happier when I started to see those numbers emerge from our statistics. And I'm very optimistic that when we report the June quarter numbers very soon, that we will see something similar. So I'm starting to grow in confidence that we're seeing the beginning of the end of this incredible nightmare. How have we done that? The way the governor, as you may be aware, the governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, declared a state of emergency related to opioids in early 2017. And we in Maryland were the first state to do that. Other states have followed suit. And at that time, the governor ordered the creation of my office, the Opioid Operational Command Center, to coordinate the statewide effort. He ordered the creation of opioid task forces in each and every county in the state, and he ordered every state agency to go into a state of high alert. And since then, everybody has been working together in government and, more importantly, in the private sector with providers, activists, service organizations, all working together to provide the services people need. The governor ordered us to apply our energies and resources in the direction in three areas: prevention and education, enforcement and public safety, and treatment and recovery. And we have made enormous progress in all three of those areas. Young people today in school are being educated about drugs and their dangers in a way they never have before. General community advertising, you're probably hearing it on the radio and on the television on a very regular basis. Harm reduction strategies that are assisting people to avoid fatal overdoses. Enforcement strategies that are interdicting vast quantities of drugs and breaking up dealer networks, as well as new public safety programs like drug court that diverts people away from jail and into treatment where they belong. We do not want to fill jails with people, low-level drug users who are nonviolent, are not dealing, they're just supporting a disease, a habit, and need to be in treatment, not in jail. And then treatment and recovery. We have at least tripled, certainly more than doubled, the delivery system for treatment services in the state of Maryland, everything from outpatient programming to residential programs of 3 or 4 days length to 28-day programs, sober living residences, halfway houses, so many things, medication-assisted therapy. So many things are now in place that didn't exist 3 years ago that you can get the help you need. It is available. 3 years ago, you might have had to wait a long time. Now you can get the help you need. So things are looking up. Things are going in the right direction. We have the right strategies and a lot of really good people working very, very hard to bring an end to all of this unnecessary suffering.
And that includes you, Steve Hsu, who we were speaking with, President, or Director, rather, of Maryland's Opioid Operational Command Center, and our other guest today, Lisa Duharty. I know you want to add something to that as well, and we'll get to Mike as well, if either one of you want to comment on that.
Sure. I just wanted to pitch in and chime in a little bit about the adulteration of fentanyl in substances. Every day have folks coming in, and once they get the results of their urine drug screen, say, I had no idea I was using fentanyl. And it's scary to them, but it's a wake-up moment for them when they realize that when they think they're using marijuana, they're really using fentanyl. Or heroin, or whatever their substance may be, it's present 90% of the time.
And that's statewide in Maryland, from your experience. Mm-hmm. That's from all over the state.
Yep, absolutely.
How about you, Mike? Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I really would just like to commend Steve Hsu and the governor, because you can't pull this off without leadership and without someone saying, this is how we're going to do it in our state. It's happening in other states, and they're having success just like we're beginning to see. So now that we have some leadership, they've also increased the availability for treatment. And that is so critical at this stage of the game. Awareness is up. The problem is there. Now everyone's looking for help. And what Steve was saying about increasing beds, increasing resources, they've also taken residential programs that would never take Medicaid which was for those who were poor, are now allowing people with Medicaid to go into 30-day programs where they couldn't before. And they were our poorest people in the communities. So they're doing great stuff. But it, believe me, it's still a huge, huge problem. Cocaine is on the increase. Marijuana use is huge in the schools with the kids. But the fentanyl, the heroin, it's still there. It's not over. It's far from over. And we still need to get a lot of people in to help.
Thanks, Mike.
Coming up next, how addiction affects mental health on I'm Listening, presented by Recovery Centers of America.
I'm Kevin, and I'm an addict. And I got here by choice. Not to choose to do drugs, not to choose to be depressed. First time I ever did my drug of choice, I thought I was going to die. And I was okay with that. And I wanted it. Not so much that I was trying to do it, but it felt like the easy thing. It felt like the way out. Long before the drugs ever became my cure, I knew something was wrong with me. There was no escape like drugs. I thought I had found the answer, whether it was conscious or subconscious, but it was what seemed like the right thing to do at that time, because I didn't think I had any other choice. It doesn't feel like I was even doing it. I was there, I did those things. Ruining my family, ruining myself. And I only got clean when I felt like I didn't have a choice. Which is funny because when I was using, I didn't feel like I had a choice either. But I stay clean because I do have a choice. And my choice is to ask for help. My choice is to be a part of instead of be alone. My choice is to be active instead of escape. But it took a lot of work to even have those choices.
Temptation doesn't exist for an addict. The disease of addiction is more powerful than temptation could ever comprehend. It whispers, it calls, it traps. The choice was made long before temptation ever had anything to do with it. Today, we're talking about the one choice an addict is ever truly presented with: recovery. Recovery begins with recognizing the problem and accepting that you can't do it alone. Whether you're the addict or someone affected by a loved one's addiction, you're not alone. I'm Listening.
We're talking here about addiction and the effects on mental health. We've seen the stats, and it's pretty staggering. I saw something recently about how 40% of patients seeking treatment for alcohol and substance use disorder report at least one suicide attempt at some point in their lives. Lisa DeHorty, the CEO of the Recovery Centers of America's Maryland Center for Addiction Treatment. Again, thank you for being here. Can you talk a little bit about how addiction affects mental health?
Sure. The connection is pretty profound and significant. And it's complex, but we're going to try and keep it simple here. So what we see and what we hear from the people that are in treatment with us at Maryland Center for Addiction Treatment is that there's a desire to alleviate those uncomfortable mental health symptoms by the use of their drug of choice. And so all of us experience some level of anxiety. We either use adaptive or maladaptive coping skills for anxiety. We'll just use that as an example. So some people may exercise, some may do yoga, some may go to talk therapy, and some people find that the use of substances is the most effective for them. However, that has long-term negative effects. But for example, someone who's depressed is frequently seeking escape through their use of substances. Someone with anxiety is seeking a sense of calm through the use of substances. We see a lot of trauma and PTSD where there's an avoidance, there's an attempted avoidance of flashbacks, and substances kind of numb that. A lady we recently treated is probably the best example of that, of all three. So she had a few years of successful sobriety and management of her depression through medication and a healthy lifestyle. And she experienced, she witnessed the overdose and death of a very close friend, and it threw her into this trauma, and her depression came back, and she started drinking again. And it's like one fed the other. So as soon as she started drinking, she stopped taking her medications. She stopped going to her therapy, and then continued alcohol use. There's no way she was going to successfully be able to manage and get any healing from that trauma experience by continued alcohol use. It's just a downward spiral, but they feed off of each other. So the mental illness of the depression and the grief and the depression fueled the alcohol use. The alcohol use had a bidirectional relationship, and without the proper treatment of unwinding all of that, it's a really tough cycle to beat. And we see that over and over and over again, where trauma is being a very one of the biggest triggers, so to speak, of people having a recurrence back to substance use. So it's important, if that's the case, to find programs that do address that specifically. But you know, once you go down that spiral, then the addiction takes hold, and it's the negative consequences come into place. There's lost jobs and relationship problems, and that downward spiral just keeps going until you get help.
Yeah. So, Lisa, then what are some of the signs to look for if you think that someone you know may be suffering from this disease?
So someone suffering from this disease, you will see, you could see, I mean, not everybody's the same. Sometimes there's increased isolation. People stop doing things that they previously enjoyed doing. Somebody that used to go to the gym all the time is kind of not interested in that anymore. A lot of times with young adults, there's this whole new friend group showing up that parents have never seen. That's a really big red flag that the old friend group is no longer there and these new people are showing up. Inconsistency and unexplained patterns of behavior, just something's off. Don't ignore that. There's inaccountability for time and money, missed time at work or school. And another big one is that level of irritability people go through. And a lot of time that is a result of the shame and guilt that people are going through, because they know something's not right. They know they're getting hounded by family and friends, like something's going on. And that's just shame and guilt of like what I'm doing and where the direction my life is going in. That's usually further down the track of the addiction, though. There's an avoidance of family, and there's also the physiological changes that we see. Change in weight, appetite changes, grooming habits change, and even attire. I mean, a complete change in the way they look, from the way they dress to the way they're grooming themselves. So these are the biggest ones. What do you got, Mike?
Well, I think some of the things, the behavior that goes on, and one of the things that really bothers me a lot is that most addicts, or alcoholics especially, we see a lot of violence in the family.
Yeah.
And that is always kept under wraps. We know, we see it, we hear it every day, we live it every day. But the abuse of children, the abuse of a spouse, is enormous. You look at places like the House of Ruth, and they'll tell you that alcohol is the leading cause of abuse of women and children. And it's usually on the weekend nights, when nobody's around. So that's a hard one. And this is where the outside family comes in. You know, grandparents, siblings, cousins, when they see something going on within a family and it becomes dysfunctional, everybody sees it. That's the thing about addiction. Everybody sees the issue, the behavior, the problems, except the addict. And they're so good, we're great. We are great at manipulating everybody. That's what we do best. And so it's important to have other people intervene and be around to be able to step in. Because all those signs, everybody knows. Everybody knows. God didn't show up for work for a week or two, and the wife is calling every day for him. I mean, we see it all the time. There's classic things. But I've been very disturbed lately of seeing how much violence that is happening within the family. because of their addiction.
Yeah. Now, we were talking about the question about, you know, things to look for in someone else that, you know, might be suffering from this disease. But how about if you don't have that family support system and you might recognize those symptoms in yourself, then how do you go about that process? Is that different?
You have to, you know, the one thing about an addict is because it's a compulsive disease, they will continue to use, continue to manipulate, to be able to use as long as they can get away with it. And they won't stop until their use creates some level of pain in their life. Could be loss of a job, get arrested, whatever, overdose, there's a lot of things. But they need that pain to happen. And when they reach that level and something bad happens, you have a window of opportunity that lasts about a minute. And that's why we need what we call treatment on demand. Because they might end up in an ER or a boss may fire them. And that's that very small window for an addict where they may be amenable, they may feel bad about what they've done, and they're open for treatment. If we can't get them right into a program, we lose them.
Yep.
We got to wait again for that cycle to come back around.
Right.
And that's critical. And when people feel that way, it usually takes somebody on the outside to step in because they're acting it out. They want help. They'll mess up at work, they'll steal, they'll rob the house, they'll do things that say, hey, I want help. I mean, I'm crying for help. And some people just don't even see that.
And is that, Mike, what you hear people refer to as rock bottom? Do you have to get to that point or recognize that in yourself?
You know, that's an old theory.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
My feeling is we can't wait for people to reach rock bottom, especially children and our kids. We can't wait. But, you know, they say, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, but you can make them thirsty. And
right.
That's what we try to do. And maybe they won't succeed the first time or the second time, but we keep trying. But I never believe that you wait, because bottoming out these days is death. And that's something we can't wait for anymore. We have to stop and intervene somewhere earlier than that.
Steve Hsu, who's director of Maryland's Opioid Operational Command Center. Steve, what are the drugs of choice in our community? Is it different for teens and adults?
The most prevalent drug, legal or illegal, of any kind in Maryland is alcohol. And alcohol, if abused, can kill, as I think we all know. The illicit drug most prevalent in Maryland is marijuana. And marijuana has been associated with various pathologies, especially for young people. Heavy use by young people is associated with the misuse of opioids, with heavy use of alcohol, and depression. The most quickly growing and the most fatal category of illegal drugs in Maryland is opioids. Opioids include traditional heroin, and as we've been discussing, synthetic opioids like fentanyl. And those drugs are extraordinarily deadly and have essentially swept the field. About 70% of all substance use fatalities in Maryland result from some form of opioid. And as I mentioned, the vast majority of those involve fentanyl. And just to give your listeners perspective, if the number of people dying from these drugs about equals the number of people dying from car accidents, suicides, and gunshots combined. That's how bad this is. And it is hitting people everywhere and anywhere in our state. The hardest hit jurisdiction in the state is Baltimore City, with about 51 fatalities per 100,000 population. So for every 100,000 people in population, 51 can be expected to die from opioids. But interestingly, the second most hard hit county is Cecil County. Cecil County is a rural eastern shore and very flat, geographically speaking, county. And the third hardest hit at about 35 fatalities per 100,000 population is Allegheny County, which is a western Maryland county, mountainous and very rural. So dramatically different from Baltimore City. And that gets to the point that these substance use disorder, opioid use disorder, and these deadly drugs can strike anyone, anywhere, at any time. Every age cohort, young, middle-aged, and old, are all being hit equally hard by these drugs. This is not a drug. These aren't drugs of young people or drugs of old people or 20-year-olds. Everybody, all across the board. Now, one of the things we've noticed over the years as this crisis has evolved is not every jurisdiction is impacted the same way. Drug cultures vary by jurisdiction. In the greater Baltimore area, including Anne Arundel, Baltimore County, Howard County, Carroll County, I think most of the people in this listening area around the Baltimore region are very much affected by opiates. Opiates seem to be the drug of choice for substance users in those areas. But when you get into the Washington metro area, Prince George's County, Montgomery County, Charles County, you see much more widespread use of drugs like methamphetamine, benzodiazepines, PCP, all very dangerous drugs in and of themselves. But we are finding that they, too, are being corrupted with fentanyl. And more fatalities are arising from those drugs than ever in the past because of fentanyl. So everything brings us back to fentanyl. It's important that your listeners educate their children, their peers, anyone in their circle about the dangers of these synthetic opioids. And any illicit drug use today is taking your life in your hands.
We'll hear some patient stories when we return to I'm Listening, brought to you by Recovery Centers of America.
I'm an addict and my name is Dustin, and I just had a feeling kind of less than others, or if I felt nervous, my nerves were so much worse than anyone else had ever experienced it. You know, like, you could be nervous, but like, you don't know how nervous I am, you know, or if you had been hurt, it couldn't be nearly as bad as the hurt that I experienced. I kind of just assumed that drugs were my solution because the first time I used, you know, it kind of quieted some of these thoughts, it numbed some of these feelings, it changed the way that I felt and took some of these things away. So I stuck with it, and I believed the lie that this is going to be the thing that fixes the way that I feel. And at all costs, I would try to get the thing that made me feel the way that I wanted to feel. I didn't use or I didn't do the things to get the drugs because I was a bad person. I felt like I needed it. It was like a desperation to just feel okay. At the end of my addiction, I didn't really know what to do. So at the beginning, I just did everything afraid, you know, and I say it like that because I never wanted to walk through fear. Anytime I was faced with a challenge, I would just use, you know. And early recovery was hard. I think I had to completely relearn how to live life. You live your way into better thinking. You don't think your way into better living. So today I'm not just clean. I'm clean and a completely different person than when I was using, but also when I started the process of recovery. If I would have listened to my thoughts and feelings about getting clean, I would not be clean today. And thank God for being just slightly open-minded enough to let somebody else suggest something to me, you know, who had been in the same exact situation that I was.
Recovery Centers of America has thrown out the one-size-fits-all addiction treatment model and created PRIZE, a unique program for people who have been in recovery but have relapsed. When entering treatment again, you don't need to start from step one. Call Recovery Centers of America today, 1-800-RECOVERY. You've succeeded in the past and are determined to succeed again. Now isn't the time to give up. It's the time to try something new. RCA has treatment locations in Southern Maryland and the Eastern Shore. Call today, 1-800-RECOVERY.
Welcome back to I'm Listening, presented by Recovery Centers of America. Here are your hosts, Jason Kidd and Gina Crash.
Also joined by Lisa DeHorty. She's the CEO of the Recovery Centers of America's Maryland Center for Addiction Treatment, MCAT. Mike Gimble is also with us, the president of Mike Gimble and Associates. Mike has held positions as the drug czar of Baltimore County, director of substance abuse for the Shepherd Pratt Health System, and is host of the syndicated drug education TV show Straight Talk. We also have Steve Hsu with us, the director of Maryland's Opioid Operational Command Center.
Mike, you're a recovering heroin addict. 46 years now?
46, almost 47.
Well, that's great. Tell us a little bit of how you got involved with heroin. And is it any different today than when you were a teenager?
Well, my story is pretty much the same as kids today, actually. I mean, it was wanting to fit in with a certain crowd, growing up in a nice family, nice neighborhood, but wanting to be like the other kids. They were cooler than I was. They played better sports. I wanted to be like them. And in order to do that, you had to do what they did. And back then, they were certainly drinking a lot, smoking a lot of pot. And I got involved with that very early on, probably around 13 years of age. By the time I reached high school, I'd worked my way up the ladder. And my entire senior year at high school, at Milford Mill High School, I was addicted to heroin. And I started in that summer and went through the whole senior year addicted to heroin. Ended up somehow graduating, not sure how, but I think they just wanted me out. And then it just got worse. I went downhill. I got arrested over and over, in and out of jail, in and out of rehabs. They didn't even have rehabs. Back then, you went into a psychiatric hospital. And it just went back and forth. I took my parents totally broke. They had nothing left. And just roamed the streets, ended up, again, constantly being arrested over and over again. And finally, at some point, you know, thank God for my family, they didn't give up, even though I took them broke. And I finally got help. I went out to California. One of the things we find with addicts is that there is a need sometimes for a geographical cure, because I had people out who were looking to kill me, and it was important that I got out of here. And I ended up going to a program in California. And nobody knows when or how a program is going to work. That's why we constantly keep at it. We keep trying to help people over and over. This time when I went into a program, it worked. And I stayed there for a long time, residential program, and worked there for many years in California. And about 9 years later, I came back to Baltimore and kind of started my career. But the kids today, it's the same thing. No one ever forced me to do drugs. No one ever forced me to put a needle in my arm. It was my choice. It was a bad choice. And it's the same with kids today. We talk about peer pressure. It's up to them. It's their choice. And when I talk to kids, I let them know that no one's going to force you to do anything. You have to check your values. You have to check your family. You have to look at what you want to do and the consequences for what you do. And what I usually do by using my story is to try to get them to realize that I'm really one of the lucky ones. Most of my friends are not around. They have died, who I use drugs with. And I'm one of the really rare birds that have lived this long. And you know, we constantly battle and we constantly try to share that information with everyone. So I'm very, very lucky.
Well, thanks, Mike, for sharing your experience. And again, that was nearly 47 years ago, right, that you needed the geographic relocation to get the help you needed. But Lisa, is that still true today?
Well, fortunately, treatment is much more available in local communities. It's one of Recovery Centers of America's an important part of their mission is to make treatment available in local communities so that traveling across state lines isn't necessary to get good quality treatment. And another piece of that is the affordability of treatment. So many years ago, insurance was not covering as much treatment as is available today, and self-pay for treatment was thousands and thousands of dollars. So we find that today families and patients are able to get the treatment they need through their insurance plans, and it's pretty affordable. So that barrier has been reduced, not completely eliminated, but really reduced. And another important factor of staying close to home is the family involvement. So the easier access families have to getting into the treatment center for education and counseling sessions, the better off the recovery process is. So family involvement is so important to long-term recovery.
And also, Mike, can you help explain the connection between addiction and mental illness from your experience?
Well, it's interesting what Steve Hsu was saying about the difference of drugs. You know, the kids today are, marijuana is the number one drug for kids by far. It's over, more than alcohol. And what we're seeing is a lot, and Steve references, a lot of psychiatric issues, a lot of mental illness issues associated with the marijuana they're using, which is so much stronger than we've ever seen before. It's a whole nother ball game when we talk about today's marijuana. And it is leading to a lot of problems. But there's always the question is, we have a lot of people in treatment, and it's very rare to find someone in treatment for addiction who didn't have a depression or was bipolar or didn't have some kind of mental illness that went along with their addiction. And everyone wants to say, which came first, the addiction or the mental health? And everyone's different. Everybody's different. But what's really exciting about the field of addiction right now is that everyone's providing both services. Used to be separate. Used to be very separate. Now we have the experience and the programs have the staffs who are able to do both. And it's important to do both. And people out there looking for help, they need to make sure that program offers a psychiatric backup as well as an addiction program that's combined to it. So it's a real big part of it, especially with kids. They keep smoking this pot, they're going to have some problems. They're going to have some mental illness problems. We see it all the time now. It's quicker than we've ever seen before. So there's a direct correlation, and I think the treatment people do an excellent job in being able to work with both at the same time.
We'll go to Lisa. What impact does addiction have on families and on the person's health and welfare?
Sure. So families, they go through such a struggle trying to first identify what's going on with their loved one. Is this addiction? Is this mental illness? What do I do about it? Families are the largest number of callers to treatment centers. It's not necessarily the person suffering from substance use disorders calling the treatment centers. It's the family saying, I see this, and I don't know what to do about it. And I can't get my son out of bed. He's living in the basement. He can't get a job. And it's just such a profound impact on the entire family. You used to have siblings watching older siblings overdose in the house. You have spouses losing jobs and putting the family at financial risk and jeopardy, losing their homes. It's so profound to hear the stories of how the substance use disordered person, how that ripples out through the entire family and creates a lot of trauma for the family. Mike?
Yeah. I think we talk about addiction, and we have for many years, even in alcoholism 50, 75 years ago, that addiction was a family disease, and that it whoever the addict is, there's three or four other people who are affected by their drug or alcohol use. And it always pans out, whether there's a family history that goes back generations or whether it's what's happening in the dysfunction of the family where the parent is an alcoholic or an addict and they can't be a good parent. And that impacts the children. So the family, no matter what happens, everyone's impacted one way or another by one or more addicts or alcoholics' behavior. And that's, again, where good treatment centers all now have a family program. It wasn't always like that. Now when you come in, they'll tell you, well, we have a family program, and you have to go through it. This is important because when that addict comes home, they need support, and you need to deal with it as well. So it destroys the families. Mm-hmm. But it's a miracle to watch how some families can be put back together through good treatment.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about that, too. So at Maryland Center for Addiction Treatment, when we have visitation, we absolutely require the family members that are visiting to participate in an hour-long education about what the recovery process is, what the disease of addiction is, how you can support your loved one and yourself, how to maintain firm boundaries, just a laundry list of tools and resources for them to start to, you know, regain their family support system and be successful in long-term recovery. And another thing we started doing, which is really has been had excellent outcome, is before someone leaves our care, we have a day with the family where they go out bowling, they go to a movie, they have lunch together. And so before they leave care, they're really reconnecting and saying, okay, this is a new start. These are the things that we're going to do together as a family to get to heal and get better, and kind of to bridge that gap between a residential treatment setting and going home. So it's been really successful.
Straight ahead, more about treatment and services on I'm Listening, presented by Recovery Centers of America.
Hi, my name is Bruce. My son is an addict, and I feel much differently about that now than I once did, but I remember how I felt then, and probably most of us who have a child or a parent or a spouse who is an addict, the feelings are all similar for us. We feel lost, we feel confused, we feel weak, helpless, and then no doubt feel regret and guilt about what you should have done, could have done, should have said. And then you'll no doubt feel some anger and feel confused. Why is this happening? Why is it happening to my loved one? Why is it happening, in my case, to my son? I remember feeling in shock, but finally accepting and understanding that it is a disease. And the who did what to whom when no longer matters. I realized that I wasn't the answer to his recovery. And all I could do was manage myself first and then manage my behavior as it related to him so that I wasn't in the way, leaving my son to deal with something which is could kill him. It was just really hard. I mean, how do you do that? It defies everything you think about as being a parent. But it was the right answer. And he hit his bottom. And then I learned that there are bottoms and then there are bottoms. So the bottom could have a basement and the basement could have a root cellar. And if you go far enough down, you wind up with a grave at the end of it all. But you do it anyways, and they can't help themselves until they decide to help themselves. So for me, it was just being there, and just whatever that value that was to him was to just be there.
If you're among the many people who struggle with addiction and have a history of trauma, Recovery Centers of America is here to help. They created their Breaking Free program to address the trauma from your past that may be fueling your drug and alcohol addiction. RCA has multiple locations in Maryland. Call today, 1-800-RECOVERY, 1-800-RECOVERY. RCA's Breaking Free program helps clear the path to your recovery, because when trauma is treated alongside addiction, people get better. This fall, make the call to Recovery Centers of America at 1-800-RECOVERY.
Now, back to I'm Listening, brought to you by Recovery Centers of America. Here are your hosts.
Jason Kidd with Gina Crash discussing treatment and services, which we got into a little bit in the last segment. Mike, is there anything that families can do to try and prevent their children from getting involved with drugs?
That's the number one question that I get every time I go out and speak to parents and to schools. And prevention starts at home. It's critical. And it starts when your child is very, very young, like 3 and 4 years old, when they learn about a good drug and a bad drug. And they know that you only take drugs from your mommy and daddy and the doctor. And they learn about taking care of themselves and being healthy. And that can start very early. But as the time goes on, the most important part is that parents have got to be involved in their kids' lives. They've got to know where they're going as they become teenagers. When they're going to parties, parents have to be involved to make sure it's a safe place to go for their kids. And most importantly, parents have to be good role models. You know, if you're a parent who drinks, then you better explain. You better not let your kids see you drive drunk or any of your friends leave your home drunk. If you're a parent that thinks that smoking weed is the greatest thing when you were in college, well, today's not your daddy's weed anymore. It's something different. It's much stronger. And parents have got to take that position when it comes to parties, when it comes to, well, I'll look the other way, or I did it when I was young. Life is different. Let me tell you, the drugs are so much stronger today. There's more violence. Kids have access to the internet. They have access to social media. There's a lot going on with their kids. And the more the parents are involved with their kids, do things with them, have alternative programs and sports events and some fun, then these kids will have a different place to be and be able to rely on their parents. That's not always happening. And I think parents do have a critical role, and prevention starts at home, and that's where it belongs, and parents have to be more involved than ever before.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mike. And Lisa DeHorty is the CEO, again, of the Recovery Center of America's Maryland Center for Addiction Treatment, MCAT. Lisa, if a parent or loved one is listening to the show and is concerned about a family member's drug use, what are the steps that they need to take?
It can be easy or complex, but in general, you're going to want to express your concern directly to your loved one and show them support in getting help. The main thing is recognizing that this is a disease. This is not them being bad or to make them feel like this is something punitive. You really want to come at it from a very supporting and loving perspective. You want to involve them in the process to identify, you know, what kind of help they need. And treatment providers are really good at helping family members sort that out. So, like, for instance, at Recovery Centers of America, if a family member calls, we will do a full pre-screen interview. And we look at things like history of substance use, medical problems, psychological problems. And there's a really good tool to help us figure out what's the best level of treatment needed at this point. Is detoxification needed on an inpatient basis? Is residential treatment needed? Or is intensive outpatient a good starting point? So it's reaching out to the proper resources once you find that there's a need for treatment and allowing them to help you guide through that process. So let's say your loved one is I'm not doing anything. I'm not getting help. I don't have a problem. Number one recommendation is for the family to get involved in some care for themselves because they can go insane with this process of trying to help someone that doesn't want help. So self-care is vital, either through Al-Anon or through a therapist that has a background in addiction treatment. Al-Anon and the therapist can also help them get their loved one to a place of accepting treatment. And last but not least is the formal intervention process. We're really fortunate at RCA where we offer that service to families because, you know, our mission is to save as many lives as possible. And sometimes intervention is the only way to get to that endpoint. Frequently, I mean, I've had daughters call about their dads. My dad is this very successful businessman. There's no way we're going to be able to convince him to get into treatment. He's so proud and, you know, all of those things that, you know, families struggle with in terms of getting loved ones into treatment. And so we connect them with a trained interventionist. They meet with the family. They create a very profoundly powerful and loving supportive script. Everyone meets, discusses it, and more often than not, that collective process with someone trained guiding them is successful in getting that person into treatment. And then the person comes into treatment and they realize, I'm not unique, and there's other people here that are exactly like me, and then that recovery process starts.
And that's where I was going to go next with the recovery process. You know, we're talking about the family and getting them in. What's it like when they're on their way out? What should the family typically expect?
Sure. You know, in the recovery process, they can expect that this is not a quick fix. This is a long haul. This is a journey. This is a life process. So typically, you know, the recovery process, at least from a residential perspective, somebody comes into treatment, the first week is really a grounding and detox if they need it. Development of treatment plan, we really dissect what does this person need, what programming would they benefit from. We go through that programming and they complete their treatment plan, but halfway through that time, we start developing a continuing care plan. The recommendation from NIDA, the National Institute for Drug Abuse, is a minimum of 90 days in that treatment process, not necessarily at an inpatient level. It could be a combination of residential, intensive outpatient, sober living. There's so many options out there right now. But it's just staying committed and not prematurely removing yourself from that extended period of time. And there's going to be an ambivalence during that treatment process. Families have to work with the treatment providers to stay firm in boundaries and their own self-care. Mike, I'm sure you've seen a lot of this.
Well, yeah. just add one piece to it, and that is when someone leaves treatment, just like we see in our prison system, we have a 75% recidivism rate in prison. We see in addiction, we also have a lot of relapse that happens. And a lot of that happens because when they leave the center, they go back to the same home, same friends, same hangout. Nothing in the environment changes. And that's critical. You know, nobody gets fixed in 30, 60, 90 days, a year, 2 years, 5 years. They need support, whether it's a 12-step program or whether it's living in a sober living home. They need that support to develop a social network that they can enjoy themselves and learn how to live without drugs and alcohol and have fun. And, you know, they're not going to come back all fixed. They're not going to get a broken arm fixed. They're getting their life changed. And that takes many, many, many years, but it takes a family network to do it.
And learning from your story earlier, Mike, you had your experience where you went to rehab in California, but it took 9 years for you to come back to Maryland and
Absolutely.
To sort of reconnect with your former, you know, just to start
Absolutely.
Over again.
Absolutely. And that was not easy either. Coming back at any time, you know, back into the same environment is not easy. And I ran into plenty of people I didn't want to run into.
Right.
But yeah, it's very important. And that goes on for a long time. And recovery houses have been a real blessing when it comes to our whole network. Mm-hmm. And it's a place where you live after treatment with other recovering addicts, living together, supporting each other. And it's a really powerful thing that's happening all over the country. And they're all over in every community. And we should support them if they're in your community.
Yes, for sure. And you've turned your life around in an amazing way. What if somebody's coming back, Mike and Lisa, from treatment and they feel themselves being, you know, tempted or slipping back into those ways? What sort of resources can you offer when they're trying to get back on their feet, but they might encounter a bit of a roadblock?
Well, I think, again, every program that I've ever seen has a plan for recovery when they leave the program. Everyone doesn't always follow the plan, but they should. And again, they need to look at their social life. They need to get a job. They need to exercise. Everybody needs to exercise. It's the best thing for recovery there is. And they need support. And again, you know, I think the 12-step program's magnificent. Some people don't like that. That's their choice. But you need support. And if you feel like you're going to fall, you need to be able to call somebody.
Right.
And that's where, again, the 12-step program has that support. Network.
Right. And we're talking again about mental and physical health as
Absolutely.
Well being so, so important, and that self-care that Lisa mentioned as well.
Stay tuned for some closing thoughts on I'm Listening, presented by Recovery Centers of America.
When I started drinking, I was 11. It's a young age, but I would steal from family members, friends, not friends. And I realized that it was so that I could feel. When I was sober, I didn't know how to feel. But once I had a drink in me, and then another, suddenly I was able to feel what I needed to feel. And sometimes I would go weeks without drinking. Bottom line was that I always always would break and have to drink again. Eventually, this ended in a multiple car collision, of which I was the perpetrator. I ended up in a psych ward, in rehabs, all before the age of 16. However, once I found my truth, I understood that I was the problem, that my way of thinking was the problem, and I'd always felt apart from and not a part of. And finally, I decided that maybe it would be worth it to be a part of.
You're tuned to I'm Listening, presented by Recovery Centers of America.
And we're back with some final thoughts on our local Baltimore, Washington segment of I'm Listening on radio.com. It's Gina Crash from today's 101.9's morning show with Jason Kidd from the Morning Drive on 94.7 The Drive, along with our guests today, Lisa DeHorty, CEO of the Recovery Centers of America's Maryland Center for Addiction Treatment, MCAT, and Mike Gimble, president of Mike Gimble & Associates. Mike's also held positions as the Drug Czar of Baltimore County, director of substance abuse for the Shepherd Pratt Health System, and is host of the syndicated drug education TV show Straight Talk, along with Steve Hsu, the director of Maryland's Opioid Operational Command Center. And we just want to get some final thoughts from everyone. Anything you'd like to share? Lisa, we'll start with you.
Sure thing. So I want to share a message of hope. I've been doing this a long time and have seen thousands and thousands and thousands of people go through the recovery process very successfully. While it is a journey, it's a very meaningful, powerful journey, and there is light at the end of the tunnel if you are stuck in this state of addiction right now. I encourage you to reach out to our staff to try and help you navigate things. That's 1-800-RECOVERY. That's Recovery Centers of America. We're available 24/7. So please reach out to us if you're in need of help.
Mike, some final thoughts?
Sure. The one thing I think we've really learned from this opiate epidemic, more than anything else, was that drug addiction doesn't discriminate, that it hits anybody, any family, any time, any community. And what's happened is that we realize that we're not alone, that it happens to rich families and poor families, and it just doesn't matter. And there's no shame to that. You know, it's part of what is happening. It's horrible. It's the worst thing that I've seen in all the years that I've been in this field. But at the same time, people are waking up. More people talk about addiction being a disease, that there's help available, I mean, more than we've ever seen before. But that realize that if it does happen, it doesn't mean you're a failure as a parent or as a wife or a husband, that it just means that somebody got sick. And if somebody got sick with a liver disease or a heart disease, you take them and get them fixed, and you hang in there with them, you know, as long as possible and as long as you can to get them back on the road to recovery, whatever that may be. The other thing I just want to close with is this. Just kind of a warning to everyone listening. We tend to judge this epidemic by the number of people who die. You know, it got bad when a lot of people died, and now it's getting better that less people are dying. Overdose is a very tiny part of the number of people who are out there addicted to drugs that need help every single day. Not everybody that uses drugs overdoses, and certainly not all die. And I want people to really, you know, keep working.
And Steve Hsu, director of Maryland's Opioid Operational Command Center, any final thoughts you'd like to add?
Well, thank you again for having me. This has been a very intriguing conversation. I hope your listeners got a lot out of it. I would just like to leave everyone listening today with the following message. There is hope. There is help out there. If you or a loved one is suffering from substance use disorder, all you need to do is dial 211, press 1. That's it. And you will get the help you need.
Thank you for listening. Remember, if you need to talk, call Before It's Too Late Maryland. Dial 211 and press 1. And if you need help with your addiction, call Recovery Centers of America 24/7 at 1-800-RECOVERY or online at recoverycentersofamerica.com. I'm also excited to announce that in November, we'll be hosting a live in-person, in-studio show in the Baltimore, Washington area with Dr. Drew to talk about all the challenges and issues that have been discussed this morning. Keep listening to this station for more information on that. I'm Gina Krash. Thanks again for listening and take care of yourself.
Recovery Centers of America has thrown out the one-size-fits-all addiction treatment model and created PRIZE, a unique program for people who have been in recovery but have relapsed. When entering treatment again, you don't need to start from step one. Call Recovery Centers of America today, 1-800-RECOVERY. You've succeeded in the past and are determined to succeed again. Now isn't the time to give up. It's the time to try something new. RCA has treatment locations in Southern Maryland and the Eastern Shore. Call today, 1-800-RECOVERY.